And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed, for the Mighty One has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and to his descendants forever." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
So I'm wondering if any of you have ever had this experience where you go to someone's house maybe for dinner or dessert, and the host says, "I didn't make anything fancy," and then they pull out something and you're like, "I just whipped this up," and you're like, "What?" So that was kind of the experience that I had with Emily when she said, "Oh, I'm just going to send you this little thing I wrote. You can maybe use it somewhere. Just throw it in." And I was like, I read it. I was like, "This is a sermon. This needs to be preached. This is amazing." So I don't mean to be making you nervous by setting you up in this way, Emily, but it really is true. I feel like our staff at Northwood has hidden talents and superpowers that we see all the time in different layers. And so this is one of them. Advent is a time of waiting and of thinking of things in new ways. And the ways in which we think about the Mary, the Joseph, and the Jesus that we thought we knew, the second that we do that, God will show us something different. And I think that that's the message for today. So, Emily, thank you for bringing us the word today.
Can y'all hear me? Okay. Advent comes from the word ad, meaning to, and venire, which means come. It's the wait for something better. It's the hope that the future will be brighter. It's the admission that things are not always good in the present, but that something better is to come. Christmas is my favorite time of year. It's also complicated. This time, a season of dichotomies and contradictions, is joyful in its anticipation and longing in its regret. And it's always been this way for me, even when I was a kid. There would come a time every 24th that I would sneak away to be by myself. And although I wouldn't have called it this when I was a kid, I would mourn. My favorite Christmas carols are in the minor key, like "O Come, O Come, Emmanuel," and "In the Bleak Midwinter," and the Coventry Carol. Weirdly, the strange dissonance between sadness and joy is always why I have loved Christmas so much. It's the fullness of time, the absolute ripest that everything can be, and it hurts because it's so loud. It's painful because it's too quiet, and it feels like the year is balanced on the point of a very sharp needle. For me, this story is about a woman, or maybe more of a girl. She's alone and scared, with someone who is reluctant to be with her. She is pregnant and on a very long trip. She goes to a town where there's no place for her. She has no money, no cultural currency, and as an unmarried pregnant woman, she has no place in a society where women are outright commodities. She's burdened and heavy and sad. This is a story about refugees, about people without recourse. I think of her starting her labor without anyone there to tell her what to expect. No midwife to hold her hand and stick fists in her lower back as she went through transition. The man with her wasn't a farmer, so he wouldn't have been experienced with birth. This was before the time of husbands as partners. He wouldn't have been there to help. This is the story of a woman who is alone and unattended to. She doesn't merit any attention from anyone. Well, anyone who matters. I know last year your theme was A Christmas Carol, which is fortuitous because this is one of my family's favorite works of literature. And in Dickens' A Christmas Carol, we meet the Cratchit family, a cheerful and hopelessly poor family. trying their best to deny their son's degenerative illness. During his time with the Ghost of Christmas Present, Ebenezer Scrooge asks that Tiny Tim be spared from his impending death. And the ghost reminds him of his own words. Well, if he would die, he'd better do it. And decrease the surplus population. The term surplus population is especially powerful because this is what the Christmas season is guilty of. Branding some as surplus, as leftovers, we miss the people who cease to have meaning for us and they become superfluous, extra humans. This is the mindset that sends people to their deaths in war. This is the view that enables us to criticize the clothes of someone using food stamps. This is the view that labels hurt and scared and oppressed people as caravans of illegals. This idea is what makes it okay to launch tear gas at children or separate people into Ayn Rand's two classes, the makers and the takers. It's not just Dickens or the gospel writer Luke who understood that Christmas is a time of social reflection. There's a reason why abolitionists penned the verses to Christmas songs as treatises against the ill treatment and systemized torture of enslaved people. In the song, O Holy Night, the third verse is, "Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease." For every Hallmark movie that espouses the true meaning of Christmas as being together with people you love, there's a hymn written by someone crying out against the misfortune of society's least cared for. For those hymn writers, for the intellectual trying to understand the cultural implications of the Christmas story, the true meaning is remembering that Christ the baby is born unplanned and poor and is celebrated in those first days solely by the poor and the socially powerless. The mother was unwed. The father was a day laborer. The first visitors were societal pariahs. One of the great misconceptions about the first Christmas, besides Mary's pristine and slimly clad blue body directly post-birth, is how clean everything is in those warm, stable scenes. After both of my sons' births, the place looked like a crime scene. Or a medieval bloodletting. The huge bruise of the placenta, the horrible messy shaking that overtakes the vacated body, and the inexplicable cold. After my boys became their own people, exiting out of me in a rush of pain and exhilaration, my body became so cold. And the midwives brought hot towels and they rubbed my skin and wrapped me in blankets and massaged my shoulders to bring back the warmth. I had one nurse, two midwives, and a partner there to bring me back to a world that we had forever changed because we added a new breath to it. Kathleen Norris, the poet, writer, and mystic, asserts that whenever we think of the Holy Family, our focus shouldn't be on their difference from other families, their supernatural grace or beauty or peace. Our focus should be on their sameness. They are the family broken down by the side of the road, sitting on the scratchy brush of the highway shoulder, the pregnant teen buying Mountain Dew at the convenience store. The baby is the baby born underweight and purple-looking, paid for by the state. The shepherds who come to visit in the story are cast-offs, dirty and undesirable, smelling of animals and body odor. They are the ones who the angels visit first. Instead of the Rembrandt version of the story, soft light seeping away from the baby like an egg yolk into the darkness, let's instead imagine the outside bathroom off of a rest area off of a highway. Imagine the mother blotting the mess up with coarse brown paper towels from the dispenser. Imagine her wrapping her newborn in a t-shirt and laying the baby under the sink on her coat that covers the perpetually wet tile crack near the drain. When she swipes at her thighs, she's shaking. The baby looks strange in the fluorescent lights that flicker like cheap stars. The mother opens the door to find her boyfriend talking to an all-night Uber driver, a long-distance trucker on hour 37 of his drive, and a man who hauls used cooking grease from fast food restaurants in the middle of the night. They want to see the baby. They want to check that she's okay. The story of that woman alone, birthing with no help, has always been so compelling to me and often untold. She and her strange assembled family and strange motley welcoming crew are alone, basically outside, and so poor. There's a reason culturally and spiritually why the story is told from the poor to the poor, why the baby is laid in a feed trough, probably speckled with bird droppings and smears of cow's saliva. There's a reason why the first people who hear about this new person are poor themselves and nomadic and untrusted. The people in this story are surplus people. They wait at the edges, the margins of the civilized. They smell bad. They live under poverty. They have dirty fingernails or greasy hair or rusted out cars. They carry signs asking for food. They push shopping carts full of bedding and cardboard and plastic bags. The angels come to them and say, wait. They say something better is on the horizon. They say something is to come that unites us all under the banner of human, of living creature. In the face of the news, the weary world rejoices. So, this Christmas season, I invite us as a church to celebrate and be merry and eat. I invite us to laugh and play with family and reminisce, but we should also remember and mourn a world that was built for some and not others. We should consider the woman who was so alone and the baby born in someone's extra shed. We should long for this narrative, the undercurrent of Christmas that is too quiet to hear over those loud retail remixes of holiday songs. Let's consider the surplus people who are still on the fringes. They are the rightful owners of this holiday, sleeping under overpasses, working all night at Walmart, asking for change outside of the mall, waiting for the better life that is to come. Thank you.